Hey, folks, thanks for checking out the podcast. Before we get going on this, please, just a reminder, if you get a second, go to iTunes and leave a nice comment about the show and the guests. If you have nothing nice to say, then keep it to yourself. But we appreciate it. Always helps to get good comments. And what also helps, here's a segue for you, is deepdiscount.com. Yes, they're my sponsor. Don't go anywhere. You know the rule. I need them so that I can help provide you with this podcast. And a little bit of support of them goes a long way in supporting me. And it couldn't come at a better time this week to be part of deepdiscount.com. They got a big sale going on and I need the money. I'm out $1,000. I need a new computer. It crashed permanently. You want to know why? I left it on for too many nights in a row. That's it. Yeah. Yeah. Can't leave your computer on. But we're gonna put people on Mars and they're going to live there. That shouldn't be a problem at all. And when I called Apple, by the way, to tell them about the problem, they're like, oh, you really got to go to the store or call the store to deal with this. I'm like, okay, can you transfer me? The guy goes, no. I go, why? He goes, because we don't have the technology. I go, you're Apple. How do you not have the technology to transfer a call? My computer right now is sleeping with my wife and making an omelet. Like, what? So deepdiscount.com has a great, great sale going on right now. And you go to my website, paulmercurio.com, click on the link. It'll take you to Deep Discount. It's a great website. You're going to find thousands of movies and TV shows at really great prices. Each month, you'll find special sales for extra savings, too, like 4K Ultra HD movies, like Steven Spielberg's Saving Private Ryan. The commemorative 20th anniversary is available on 4K Ultra HD. Comes out this week. I picked up Lara Croft Tomb Raider in Ultra HD. Oh, my God. I'm leaving my wife for that movie. Not for her, just for the movie. It looks incredible. Also picked up The Untouchables. Really great classic movie starring Kevin Costner for under $10. Barbarella, something I picked up in the horror sci-fi category. Really cool old school movie. If you don't know it, get it. It's cheap. You got to own these things. You don't want to waste time searching with the remote and then the batteries are out or the little back that holds the batteries in is gone and they keep falling out. And then you're like, you want to just move to the woods. You're going to find classics from back in the day, hard to find titles, new releases, really cool stuff on deepdiscount.com. Here's another new release out this week, 50 Shades Freed, the final movie based off the worldwide best-selling books by E.L. James. This climactic chapter completes the trilogy. Will it be a happy ending? Go pick it up. Find out. There's an unrated copy now. Unrated. Come on. You don't need anything else. That's it. Just that and the movie, and you're good for the rest of your life. It's on DVD or Ultra HD for a great price at deepdiscount.com. Be good to yourself. Check out deepdiscount.com. I've been using it. I got a t-shirt. I got this really cool little game. I got 5 movies now. deepdiscount.com, go to my website, paulmercurio.com, click on the logo, and go save yourself some money and have some fun checking out the site. My guest this week, award-winning journalist Katie Couric. Couldn't be more excited to have her on. We have a really cool conversation about her docuseries on Nat Geo, and we fix all the problems in the world, too. All right, enjoy Katie, everybody. Welcome back to the show. A friend of mine is here, and a great journalist, 6-time Emmy winner, Peabody Award winner, recipient of the Edward R. Murrow Award, Katie Couric.
Hi, how are you? Good. I'm so sorry, I have a little bit of a cold, so I probably sound very nasally.
No, you sound fine, and you look fantastic. You dressed in very sophisticated black.
So I have like
evening wear.
Yes, it's not so much. It's a little day to evening. You know, you could throw on a jacket and make it a little more casual ball, It's a jumpsuit, I guess you would call it. Anyway.
Which is weird, because I was going to wear my black jumpsuit, so I'm glad I didn't.
I know. I'm so bummed you didn't.
Well, thanks for being on the show.
You're welcome. Nice to be here with you.
And I'm sorry you're not feeling well, but we'll sort of talk, and we won't think about that. And I'm getting you, as a gift, as a thank you, a strand of pearls to go with the black outfit.
Thank you.
I ordered it on Amazon. They're not real, okay. But I had a card. So I want to talk to you. We're going to talk about your Nat Geo series, America Inside Out, a docuseries, which I think I watched it. It's really important that it's out there. It's really, really well done. And I learned some things that I didn't know, which my wife said to me, one of them in particular, rewriting history, seems like something that should be taught in a part of a course. And I was wondering if this came out of, you did the Gender Revolution documentary. Was there a plan to do a series of these then, or was this sort of an outgrowth of that?
It was an outgrowth. You know, I did this documentary for the first time for National Geographic. I had met them. They are in the midst of really sort of redefining who they are. I think they want to be about the exploration of ideas as well as places. Huh. And Courtney Monroe, who runs the Nat Geo Studios, really was interested in this gender identity, gender revolution documentary that I proposed, because so much has happened, Paul, in terms of our perspective on gender.
Yeah.
And it's so different than when you and I grew up. It was a very binary culture, blue, pink, this whole idea of gender fluidity, to be gender nonconforming, the, you know, surfacing, much people being much more sort of open about trans, being transgender, intersex individuals. You know, it was one of those things that was maybe whispered about, but really kept in the closet. So I wanted to help people understand, you know, we're going through these massive changes in our country and really in the world. It's almost as if tectonic plates are rubbing up against each other. And I think it's hard for an older generation to understand some of the things that are happening that we're witnessing transforming before our eyes. So that's what I wanted to do with gender. They were really pleased with that documentary, wanted to do more. And I said, well, why don't we do a series of important issues that we feel are not adequately explored in the mainstream media? And they wanted to do it.
Yeah. And the subject matter ranges from race to white anxiety to the effects of technology on us as human beings and
political correctness on college campuses and beyond.
By the way, if you're a comic now, worst place to work is a college campus, because you can't say anything. Some of them actually have you sign a document that says you won't talk about politics or this or that, the other thing.
It's interesting because, as you know, some comedians just don't do it.
Yeah.
Chris Rock, I think Jerry Seinfeld, a lot of people.
Yeah. I'm not interested in doing it. Now, if you think about George Carlin, it was through the counterculture that he was able to go from what he called AM, a suit and tie guy, to sort of the somewhat radical. He couldn't do it today there. I'm not even sure. I mean, you get it in the comedy clubs, but you have to push back, because you do have to. I just think life lives in the gray areas. And that's what one of the themes that came out of this in the different, you know, which was really great. Like, it wasn't just like a black and white, this is bad and this is good. And especially the rewriting history one, which focused on, taking down Civil War statues and so forth. You really gave time to both sides on that.
Well, you know, yes and no. I mean, I really was just searching for the information that would help people gain the knowledge they would need to have an informed opinion.
You know,
there's so many opinions without portfolio in this day and age. You know, people spouting off about this, that, and the other thing, lashing out, making instantaneous judgments. I thought, you know, the news cycle is so insane. We don't have a chance to step back and think about things, I think, in a considered fashion. So, yes, I mean, it's not really an attempt to talk to both sides. I think with each topic, I just try to kind of peel the layers off the onion and learn something about the topic that will help people be more empathetic in some cases, more understanding, and as I said, just better informed.
Well, yeah, and what I meant by both sides is not necessarily advocating one or the other, but you opened my eyes to the thinking of people that were fighting against the idea of taking down the statue. Like, I think it was a councilman that you were talking to at a monument, and he kept saying, well, this is to honor the soldiers who fought. And you made the good point that really it sort of represents the sort of slave state.
Right, that was the state senator. Gerald Allen from Tuscaloosa, Alabama, who after Mitch Landrieu removed four statues of Confederate icons, then passed a law, or introduced legislation rather, in the state of Alabama saying it was against the law to take away, to remove any statue that had been placed there before 1977.
Right, right. So it became eye-opening for me, sort of the rationale. And then you said, well, you know, kids can learn from this. And you say, well, are they learning from it? And I personally, when I heard him say that, that rang hollow to me when he said it. And then he just seemed to be searching for rationales that didn't really hold water for me as the viewer.
Yeah.
To keep that statue.
It was surprising. I thought he would be a little better prepared, to be honest with you. You know, he knew what I was coming to talk to him about, but I thought his argument felt pretty specious, you know. But I do think there is a lot about heritage and Southern pride. But what I tried to do is explain the lost cause narrative, why this took such a strong hold into the national consciousness, how, you know, these views were established and why they've been so strongly adhered to through the years.
Right.
But more importantly, you know, I'm a white woman, and it was important for me to hear from the 16-year-old African-American high school student who started the petition to remove the statue of Robert E. Lee, and Don Gathers, who started the Black Lives Matter movement in Charlottesville, and Paul Mason, the African-American history professor, you know, to talk about what these symbols mean to African-Americans, many African-Americans in this country. Not all, you know, some, there are also some who believe they should stay, but just in general, the symbolism. And I think, I don't know, just it makes you think about a lot of things. It makes you think about the importance of public spaces, too.
Oh, yeah.
Because what you put in public spaces really, it telegraphs the values and the attitudes of the community.
Yeah, absolutely.
You know, and you know, while a lot of people were very upset with Mitchell Andrew for taking them down, you know, I think you listen to him, you listen to Wynton Marsalis, you listen to some of these historians talk about the timing of these statues, when they were erected.
Right, which is a great fact. I mentioned that it was 20 over the 20-year period after Jim Crow,
It was sort of at the height of the Jim Crow era in the early 1900s. You know, I think people think they were put up immediately after the Civil War.
It was like 37 statues or something.
Well,
like that.
I mean, there were a lot of statues. Oh, do you want to know how many in general? There's 650 monuments. Nationwide, and more than 85 public schools have been named after Confederates, 80 cities and counties, 10 U.S. military bases, and 9 state holidays. And I think one of those interesting things that we pointed out in that hour is the Southern Poverty Law Center saw two spikes. One was in the height of the Jim Crow South, when African-Americans were trying to make gains and strides. And the other was right after Brown v. Board of Education in 1954, the Supreme Court decision, you know, mandating school desegregation. So, you know, I think when you hear some of the motives and the attitudes behind some of these namings and behind some of these statues, it does make you at least think about that.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Well, you know, you had this something that you said that really struck me. You said, I'm hoping that maybe the personal will trump the political and that we'll once again appreciate each other on another level. And I really feel like that came through in what I watched. And I don't know. I want to think that the pendulum can swing back, hopefully. But I mean, it just seems like we're so divisive right now. And I personally think cable news had something to do with that, because once it became a ratings game and it was less about news for certain networks and more about commentary and holding on to your ground, it was a national pulpit combined with social media to really put a wedge between people.
Well, I think people are getting affirmation instead of information these days.
Yeah.
And now everyone really is a commentator, giving their point of view. And sometimes that's warranted. And I think a lot of journalists have been doing a great job under very difficult circumstances. And but I do think that the era of straight news, kind of a BBC type broadcast, I guess PBS is the closest thing, NewsHour, but those things just seem to be a thing of the past. And I think it does put people in silos and echo chambers, and the people they follow on social media, I think, reinforce their point of view.
Right.
Unless they just want to get into these trolling kind of screaming matches on Twitter. And so I think that you don't have an opportunity to hear, you know, in a calm, measured way, someone else's opinion.
Right.
And I think that's a shame, because I think the more your opinion is reinforced, the less flexible you are in hearing and actually hearing what other people have to say.
Yeah. I mean, I go on some of the shows that I'm talking about, but trying to sort of be an objective voice and bring some, you know, levity sometimes. But I was on a panel and Obama had said that the Constitution was a flawed document, which it was. And
well, nothing's perfect.
Right.
Anyway.
Exactly. And so the Republicans on the panel were using that as a wedge, you know, to sort of, you know, a hammer to pound Obama. Well, that's, he shouldn't be speaking like that. It's a perfect document. And there was an African-American gentleman on the panel who was a Republican. He said, yeah, it's written. It's a perfect document. And I did the same thing your eyes just did. They got big. And I was like, and I said to him, well, really, based on that document, you're really a torso here. You're 3/5 a person. So I don't know how you could say that. And what broke my heart was that he couldn't see the color of his own skin through his political beliefs. So this quote really resonated with me about, you know, personal versus political. And that was a really eye-opening moment for me, because there couldn't be a bigger issue that you could sort of turn your back on your political beliefs for 5 seconds on, and he couldn't, you know.
Yeah, well, I think people get so invested and deeply entrenched, and it has become their identity.
Yeah.
You know, and I think identity politics really are ruling the day. And, you know, this was just a chance to not only identity politics, but very shallow coverage. Let's be honest. I mean, Charlottesville came and went on August 12th.
Right.
That horrific so-called Unite the Right rally with all these neo-Nazis and white supremacists. And I don't think after that, people even thought about, well, what's going on? What was this about?
Right.
What have these Confederate statues come to symbolize,
right,
as the Confederate flag did,
yeah,
when Dylann Roof shot all those people in Charleston?
Yeah.
And Nikki Haley, I thought, very bravely and courageously decided that she would remove the Confederate flag from the South Carolina State House. And, you know, I just feel like everything goes so quickly and we're reading so much and getting these little snippets of information that it does not allow us to step back, connect the dots, and sort of consider some things.
Yeah, you did that in the piece too, where you noted that the 14th Amendment was passed, but then white supremacy really took hold. So a slightly watered down version of slavery took place.
Right.
And is, you know, still here to this day.
Sort of the long tail of slavery. You know, I thought it was really important to talk to Bryan Stevenson.
Oh, he was
about
really,
this. Yeah. I so admire him. I think he's one of the most eloquent people I've ever had the pleasure of talking to. And, you know, I really wanted to transition from what, you know, here are these statues. They're all over the country. Should we be commemorating these people? You know, asking that question. And if we're commemorating them, what history have we neglected or forgotten or failed to confront?
Right.
And I thought that was really an important term turn in the arc of the hour.
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, you asked him, why do we have so much trouble coming to terms with our past? And he said, quote, "We think saying I'm sorry makes you weak, and that has to change in this country." And that really resonated with me, both in terms of what that subject matter was for that hour, but going back to what I was talking about, sort of the political discourse, it's a sign of weakness if you give up on one of your 6 talking points. You have to win them all, or it's a lot, right? And so that's where I don't know if we can come back to some I hope we can, but that really, really resonated with me.
Yeah, I hope so. I mean, I think if you look at countries like Germany, Rwanda, South Africa, especially Germany, has really kind of unabashedly, clear-eyed, you know, dealt with its role in the Holocaust.
Yeah.
And you really cannot forget Germany's role if you spent any time in Germany in terms of how it's taught, how it's memorialized, and how it's been integrated into its national narrative.
Right.
And I think that we just all need to say this is something that was horrific. And, you know, I thought it was interesting, Paul, I don't know if you noticed that Robert E. Lee, the distant relative of Robert E. Lee, General Robert E. Lee, came upon our crew when we were filming and he said, "Can't we just move on?"
Yeah.
And I think that's honestly the attitude of many people who sort of feel like, you know, this is 2018. That's the distant past. You know, I had nothing to do with this. Mm. Perhaps my relatives somewhere down the line did. But, you know, we can't be blamed for the sins of our father. And I understand that sentiment. But I think without kind of at least listening and hearing and accepting and appreciating all the history that we've never acknowledged. You know, I think Bryan Stevenson's lynching memorial is so extraordinary because you think of all those people who were brutally murdered. And
then the photographs.
And terrorized, you know, talk about domestic terrorism. Yeah. He says, you know, he really resents when people refer to 9/11 as our first incident of domestic terrorism, but it really wasn't. Mm-hmm. And the fact that so many of these people were never properly buried, forgotten. The perpetrators were never, ever brought to justice. And to be able to recognize, honestly, simply recognize the lives lost by looking at these mason jars full of soil
that was
unearthed by descendants of these lynching victims. It was so unbelievably powerful to me. And every mason jar, Paul, tells a story. Yeah. Brian told me about one school teacher where little boys were throwing rocks at her. And like any adult, he said, she admonished them and said, "Boys, don't throw rocks." Mm-hmm. Well, the fact that a black woman said that to a group of white kids, they went home and told their parents, and this whole gang came and murdered her. Mm-hmm. And then ended up setting fire to her house. And she was a beloved African-American school teacher, and no one in that community, that black community, could ever even speak of it. Mm. I mean, it's just unbelievable when you think about the things that happened less than a century ago in this country. It just blows my mind. And we have to kind of just face it head on and say, these were the sins of our fathers, and we have to recognize it, because without truth, there can be no reconciliation. Yeah. There can be no moving forward. And I think you also have to appreciate this long tail of slavery that Brian talked about and how it has had effects to this day. You know, just in a separate hour, Paul, I talked to these EMS workers in Johnstown, Pennsylvania, and I've told this story a couple of times, but they were talking about, you know, I did a whole thing on white anxiety, working class anxiety, and went to places like Fremont, Nebraska, and Storm Lake, Iowa,
Erie, Pennsylvania,
Johnstown, Pennsylvania, places that I just would never probably go otherwise.
Right.
And I'm really grateful that I got a chance to go to those communities, because so many reporters just stay in New York in studios and talk to experts, quote unquote. And to really get out in the country and listen to people is, I think, really missing from our media diet and the media landscape. But just real quickly, they were all talking, and it was probably four white guys. We're sitting around a table having cold pizza, and I threw out a couple of what I knew would be hot button issues. So I asked them how they felt about Colin Kaepernick. Well, you can imagine they were very, very critical of Colin Kaepernick. I asked them about Black Lives Matter, and predictably, they said all lives matter. Mm. And as we were talking, a black EMS worker named Carlos came in and sat down. And I said, "Carlos, what do you think?" And he started talking from his heart about his experience hearing about lynching victims when he was a little boy for simply having a black man even look at a white woman like me. Mm. And he said, you know, he talked a little bit about, it's more than Black Lives Matter. It's really the continuation of a movement. Mm. And all those men looked at him and they said, you know, I've never really thought about it that way. And that really changes my perspective in many ways. And one of them said to him, you know, we've never wanted to bring this up because we didn't want to make you feel uncomfortable. And I said, well, maybe like just sitting around a table.
Yeah.
Talking like people.
Yeah.
Instead of behind Twitter handles.
Exactly. Well, what is that about that they need an award-winning journalist to prod them into that conversation and they can't consider getting there on their own? Even when I say getting there, I mean just even to have the conversation.
Well, I think, you know, you're so programmed with the news you've been digesting. I think people make value judgments about other people, yeah. who they are and the positions they take. Maybe right. they don't want to ruffle feathers or
and you're not
up.
Reading or watching news that's the other side of the aisle from you, so you're getting just the affirmation of what you want.
Yeah,
so
but also like just saying, hey Carlos, like, what do you think of this?
Yeah.
You know, we feel like, you know, the police are being unfairly maligned. And, you know, it always struck me, why can't Black Lives Matter and Blue Lives Matter?
Right.
You know, why do you have to pick sides?
Right.
Why can't you say most policemen are doing really the best they can and great work, and there is some systemic implicit bias that I think affects sometimes everyone's judgment, not just police officers,
right.
but it's
right.
sort of how we're culturally conditioned, but that there are many really fine people
right.
on police forces all across the country.
Absolutely.
And there's many fine people in the Black Lives Matter movement. And why can't there be a Venn diagram where you can appreciate both?
I don't know. That's exactly what I was saying at the top of the show, that, you know, the life lives in the gray areas, you know, and for some reason we can't get ourselves there. I was doing a show in Minnesota and I talk to the audience. I like to talk to the audience and I bring them on stage now and talk to them. And I was a lesbian, very nice woman. Her partner was there. How did you guys meet? They laugh. The partner was married with three kids. They met at a softball game. They struck up an affair. She divorced her husband. They got married. The lesbians and the husband and the three kids all live in the same house. And they sleep in the bed that the husband and the wife used to sleep in. Okay. Place goes loving it. It was fun. It was whatever. And then the next night, the two lesbians brought their three daughters to see this. Because they wanted, and this isn't about me, but they just wanted to see that you could have a conversation like this and it's fine, right? Like it was just like talking to a heterosexual couple, except they happen to be homosexuals and they whatever, right? The whole reason I'm bringing this up is one of the women said to me, when they first got there Friday night, the first show, and sat down, they were seated and across from them were a heterosexual couple who were clearly uncomfortable with them being gay. And you can kind of tell, you know, the
body
look,
language,
whatever. Yeah,
whatever.
You know, and so after they came on stage and told their story, it was a 180 with those two people. They bought them drinks. They joked with them. They thought it was such a great story. And again, this isn't about me, but it took the boogeyman out of what are those dirty gay people doing? You know what I mean? Like it's just, and it was, they realized they're no different than we are.
Well, one of the things that Dr. Oz said after my gender documentary, which really stuck to me, he said, it's hard to hate up close. And, you know, yeah. And that was in many ways my North Star, not for every episode, but for a lot of these episodes when I talked about what is it like to be a Muslim in America,
yeah.
you know, to demystify people and show them, show other viewers, non-Muslim people, that these people want the same things we want.
Yeah.
They want to contribute to their community. They want their kids to grow up healthy and happy and productive.
But
they
don't you think these cliques that end up forming
these tribes,
tribes, it's all out of insecurity. It's all out of
fear
and insecurity. Like if I don't, and lack of understanding, like if I don't understand you, I don't want to work at trying to understand you, and you're different than me, and that scares me. So I'm going to huddle up with my people.
Well, I think there must be something probably quite primal about it,
yeah.
right? About people who stick to people who are like them.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I think there's probably something, you know, in zoology that
right.
kind of tells us why that happens.
Right.
But I also think, you know, people stay fairly segregated and yeah, I mean, I don't know what the answer is, but it would be great. I know, I think Mitch Landrieu told me he used to host these conversations with communities and they'd come in and just have these rational discussions. And instead of having this contentious issue in a city council meeting where there are two sides about any given issue, an opportunity, I think we're losing that sense of community.
Oh, yeah.
And we've developed this sort of virtual community that really doesn't make us proximate, as Brian would say. As you can tell, I'm a big fan of Brian Stevenson, but I moderated a panel on race at Stanford, and he talked about the need to be proximate. And I think what he meant is, you know, we're not around people who aren't like us. You know, that neighborhoods used to be so much more, I don't know, that's not necessarily true, because I think there's been a lot of de facto segregation in housing. Right. But I think that, you know, there used to be a little more cultural and hopefully socioeconomic diversity in communities. And I just think, I don't know, I just don't see enough of it personally, but even in my own life. I'm not around that many people who are different than I am. That's why I so valued an opportunity to spend time with Muslims in Chapel Hill, North Carolina, and a doctor in Minnesota.
Yeah, that was what you really traveled for this, and you really immersed yourself. And I was shocked that you were at Charlottesville. And I'm like, oh my God, she's like there. You have shots of the car going through. And the thing that really moved me was that you said you were just sort of looking at the chaos and said, it almost makes you want to cry. And I really thought that that was a great moment that took it beyond journalism, because it was nice to have somebody say what I was feeling, and it still made it okay. The hour still worked for me in terms of objectivity and all of that. I thought it was a really great moment.
Well, you know, it's hard to be objective about white supremacists and neo-Nazis,
isn't it?
I feel no compunction or responsibility to be objective when it comes to certain people. I just don't.
Yeah.
And, you know, I remember when I interviewed David Duke when I was at the Today Show, and my dad, who was a political journalist for the Atlanta Constitution, I mean, I ripped David Duke a new one and read his quotes back in very Tim Russert fashion about Jews belonging to the ashbin of society and all these just despicable things he had said. And my dad called me and he said, I'm so proud of you, you know, because... You know, that reminded me of Edward R. Murrow, because some things are just so repugnant and so unacceptable, they have to be called out.
Yeah,
and you have to put your objectivity aside in order to have some kind of moral authority instead.
I was really glad that you did that. I didn't see it coming, but I just thought it was like, it made everything just more human on some level, you know, and I mean, the whole thing, because you talk about the communities and you have these statues, that great moment where they show the little plaque about slavery. And then you,
like the size of your paper in front of you.
Right, 8x10. And then these massive monstrosity of statues that are, you know, and we have a lot of catching up to do with regard to like a Germany or in terms of owning it. And it might take a long, long time for people to own it, but... I understand what you're saying about the technology, because that ties into the gaming piece that you did. And so how separated people are. I didn't know that there was an addiction.
A rehab center. Yeah.
So this young college kid couldn't stay 12 hours a day, something like that.
Yeah, which is clearly, I think, shows... other issues, right? Issues, whether it's socialization or self-esteem issues or... You know, who knows? But yes, he's such a nice kid.
Yeah.
And he went for 7 weeks to this place called Restart in Washington State because, listen, I'm addicted to my phone. It
that
is
test,
awful.
Those tests that they were doing with you were utterly fascinating.
Right. And well, they increase your anxiety level and it's impossible to focus. There's no such thing as multitasking. The very act of having your phone within your line of vision.
Right.
Is actually taking attention and the ability to focus away from your brain.
Right.
Because you're cognizant of it sitting there.
Right. The stat that it takes 23 minutes to refocus on your task.
Think deeply about something. And that's why sort of these constant interruptions and this quote unquote trying to multitask or you know, using several screens at once, your brain can't really accommodate that.
No, and the message that came through to me on that, there are a couple of major ones, but probably the major one for me was the gentleman that said
Tristan Harris?
About boredom is good.
Larry Rosen, right.
And how that create that leads us to creativity, but we won't let ourselves get bored. But if you want to elaborate on that,
no, it's true. Well, you know, think about it. You know, when you were a kid growing up, when I was a kid growing up, or even now, if, you know, there was, let's say we're in a car driving, or we are, you know, somewhere, let's say we're walking in the park. If you have your device and you're either listening to something, a podcast like yours or mine, Paul, which we highly encourage, but it's not all the time.
Yeah, exactly.
Or you're somewhere and you're, you know, you just are sucked into this sort of the vortex of useless crap and information that your phone
texting,
is.
Yeah.
You don't have a chance to like, wow. Look around, think, ruminate, you know, marinate on something. And you think about kids, and there is actually a real benefit to daydreaming.
Yeah.
That's why we have some of our best ideas in the shower.
Yeah.
When we're not distracted, we're just kind of there alone with our thoughts.
Right.
And if you're being pulled by your phone, you don't have the opportunity. And the science shows the part of your prefrontal cortex that fires up when you're, you know, when you're being creative or having ideas, it cannot do that when you're constantly distracted by other things.
Yeah. Yeah, and that came through, and all of that came through. And
how about Larry Rosen talking though about the blue screens before you go to bed, and they're worried that kids are developing plaque from a lack of sleep.
I thought about myself
from reduced melatonin, increased cortisol.
Yeah,
and they're worried that they're going to have some of these memory loss issues in their 30s, 40s, and 50s because of this constant. So, you know what I really wanted to do with this series is say, hey, everybody, like, hey, press pause for a second.
Mm.
And maybe we need to just think about all these revolutionary changes that we're witnessing. Maybe try to understand them better and understand each other better. Mm.
And I think that's really come through. And, you know, you also said, if I can bring people along to the journey and I can be a proxy for their confusion and lack of understanding, and they can learn from me. Going in, did you seem to know, was there anything that came through to you in terms of your lack of understanding?
Well, like, of course, I didn't know about the Southern Poverty Law Center research. I didn't know, I learned so much from every hour. It was like writing a thesis on six different topics.
Yeah.
So, you know, every hour I learned something. I didn't know all about technology. I knew that probably there were some things we should be thinking about in terms of its ubiquity in our lives.
I didn't know about those creepy doll women.
That
was a little like
weird.
Yeah.
And I kind of wanted to talk about, is technology replacing us?
Yes. And the AI aspect of it is really, really
like,
interesting.
Is it replacing us? Is it, you know, replacing us at work? Is it replacing us in relationships?
Yeah.
Is it going to make basically human beings obsolete in some way, shape, or form? You know, I read a statistic that 38% of jobs are at risk of being replaced by automation in the next 15 years.
Mm.
And
right,
I think we need to start thinking about these things and preparing for the future and stop talking about Donald Trump's tweets 24/7.
I know.
And like say, hey, We've got big things happening in this country and in this world.
But it's like taking medicine for people, and the candy
is Donald.
I know. I'm with you, and also for the ratings, the Trump tweets are the candy that everybody chews on.
It is sort of like it's almost like heroin, isn't it? In terms of kind of that must be lighting up our prefrontal cortexes,
or
you know, it might be a weird kind of dopamine, right?
I think it is. And I, you know, it's like appointment television when you go home now. It's like, what crazy thing has happened, you know? And
right.
It's like you can't keep away from it. And all of this, I hope, brings us back, you know? I mean, I hope you do more of these. I don't know if you're planning to, but I think that you definitely achieved what you wanted to achieve in terms of sort of getting us to stop, take a breath, and look at why we're not looking at things the way we should or could, not just in terms of our own views, but even just in terms of the way technology is affecting us. Like, what are the things that are causing this outside of ourselves?
And technology is kind of weirdly amplifying our divisions. You know, as you mentioned earlier, with kind of, you know, self-selected echo chambers. But, you know, I did this whole hour on, as I mentioned, sort of this age of outrage. And, you know, social media is fantastic and when it can galvanize sort of people to join forces in a cause that is worthy and noble.
Mm.
But it can also serve as this mob mentality that can really, that we need to think about how it's being utilized.
Yeah.
And I talk about sensitivity readers for authors. I talk about cultural appropriation. When is it appropriation? When is it appreciation? And, you know, for me, that's not my world. I had to understand what that meant and why that was so offensive. And really, the offensive thing is that people have not been brought to the table. You know, they have, it has not been a level playing field.
Right.
And opportunities have not been open. And so it's not only about stealing someone's culture, it's about putting up barricades that allow people from these cultures a seat at the table.
Right. That's a really good point. And I mean, I'm hoping that this has the dent that it should have because I haven't seen anything like it and I think it's great.
Well, I'm hoping that, and maybe you and your wife did this, I hope so, where after you watched an episode, thought, wow, I never thought about it that way. Or I never really thought of that perspective. Or, gee, that's something maybe we should be paying attention to.
Yeah, big and small. Even just the idea of sort of the lack of physical space representing the slave aspect of slavery versus the statue. Just all of that. I want my son to watch all of them, particularly one on rewriting history, because there are things that I didn't know, and I'm kind of a history buff, and I just think that that's really important because once people in their own way can digest this stuff, sometimes people have to arrive at these conclusions on their own without being pushed.
Right.
And so in the quiet of their own home and sleeping on it, then they can go, okay, well, maybe I should be rethinking this particular thing.
Well, you know, I tried not to be too doctrinaire about any of these. And
no, you're not. It was
like
just the right touch.
People have sort of first person, but even I was in New Orleans for Jazz Fest last weekend. I was talking to some friends of mine who
I love that Jazz Fest.
Yeah, I'd never been. It was been it before. It was really, really fun, and I feel like I gained like 10 pounds. But anyway, and I was talking to some friends of mine, and I was sort of explaining to them everything I learned in the in the making of these hours, and particularly we're talking about Confederate statues because they were from New Orleans originally, really, really ticked off at Michelangelo. And I started sort of telling them the backstory. And, you know, they said, wow, you know, that makes us rethink this whole thing little bit, you know? So just a little bit of information that we don't seem to have the appetite for or the tolerance for or the patience for can really move mountains. And, you know, that's, I hope that more journalists, especially on television, they tackle some of this stuff.
Yeah, I hope so too. And you know, there's plenty of places to do it. It's not like it was 1960 or 70 where there were three networks.
Well, I think that's one of the reasons documentaries are so popular with young people.
Yeah.
Because they actually do a deep dive into important topics. Similarly, podcasts.
Right.
You know, my 22-year-old listens to podcasts and you think, oh, well, this is the Snapchat generation. Yeah. How can they be interested? But I think they're craving for a deeper understanding.
And also, like, I think they know that they can arrive at conclusions on their own and they don't have to be force-fed things, you know? I think that they're more independent and I think on some level, you know, smarter sooner maybe than we were, you know, because of the world that we live in. So, I mean, I think it's all good. It's all important. And I agree with you. I hope some of the journalists sort of, you know, take a beat and, no pun intended, because that's the point of the series, and sort of think about how they want to report some of this, because I just think it's too fast and too loose a lot of times.
Can I ask you a question, since you're a comedian, about in my Age of Outrage hour, we talk about some of these sort of cultural touchstones are being reevaluated, like 16 Candles and some other Molly Ringwald, John Hughes movies. And also, Apu, the Indian convenience store owner, and as you saw, there was a documentary about this and about how sort of that portrayed people like Apu and Hank Azaria saying that he is rethinking the character. And I'm curious what you think about that.
I think that in terms of the whole political correctness and sort of where we, and sort where the lines are.
I don't think you have to talk sort of, you know, about it kind of macrocosmically, but how do you feel about Apu in general and about people feeling uncomfortable with that character?
Well, you know, I'm torn because I'm Italian, and I actually talk about this. If you're a European immigrant, you assimilated into the majority. So it's okay to make off-color ethnic stereotype
jokes.
Sorry,
that's my tissue.
Oh, that's okay. And it's okay to make those jokes and people laugh, right? Like mafia, that's the thing that people think of. And every movie that comes out of Hollywood, even a comedy like My Cousin Vinny, is basically about the mafia. Now, I'm not crazy about that, and I could be writing letters all day, but I do think that this is, for me, where it's in the gray area. Apu and the people of that culture do talk a certain way, which tends to lend itself to being funny. I don't particularly do that kind of stuff in my act, but they do talk that way. But it's okay. I have a friend who's Chinese, and every time he sees me, he goes, "Hey, Paulie, how you doing? Paulie. Nobody says anything. Now, if I went, "How you doing then, news 10 guy, then I'm racist. So people have to think about all of their stuff, you know? People
right.
have to think about, like, it should be across the board, or you go, you know what? This is sort of how we live our lives, and if no harm is meant, then I think it's okay. Now, like I said, on a personal level, I get this, you know? This whole mafia thing and whatever. And I could be upset about it, but I'm like, okay, it is what it is, and it's not going to change. And when they cast people in the mob, they look like, in movies, they look like me because I'm Italian and I look Italian. So I can't get upset. Why don't they do a blonde hair with blue eyes? It's like, that's not going to work. So I feel like there's this thing called selective righteousness where regarding certain races and certain ethnicities, it's okay. And certain ethnicities, it's not okay. And so I think we have to figure out if it's not okay for one, it's not okay for all of us. You know,
I guess you have to, I guess it's in the eye of the offended, right?
Yeah. Now, I mean, listen,
right? I guess, right?
I mean, there are going to be some Italians that are offended by what I just described. I particularly am not. And then there are going to be some people of Indian descent who are going to be offended by Apu and some who are not.
Right.
And so I think that we need to sort of try to make everybody happy to some extent. But also understand that not everybody thinks exactly the same regarding a particular issue. And if you don't think the way that is the quote unquote politically correct way, it doesn't mean that you're a bad person either.
Right. And I think a lot of groupthink does tend to take over on social media. Mm-hmm. And I think, you know, it was interesting. Who was I talking to about Kanye West? Oh, I think Geraldo and Andy Cohen. And about Kanye saying, you know, I don't want to be forced to think a certain way. And you can kind of appreciate what he meant, even if you find his support of President Trump repugnant or undesirable.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I just think that, you know, people need to sort of like have an open mind about things that they really believe in, but other people don't. And I don't think it makes those other people a bad person, because then, you know, if it's clearly racist, then it's wrong. Okay. If it's a cultural thing that some people get offended by and other people don't feel it's offensive, well, then that's a conversation, you know, because just like, people have a right to feel the way they feel about things without being sort of forced into a position that they don't want to be in, right? Like you talked about sort of the EMT worker coming in and giving another perspective, and the guy's going, "Oh, I didn't think about that." Nobody twisted their arm, and that's why I think they started to get there.
Right.
But I do think that, you know, there's a, you know, I had a woman on a subway call me an asshole because she said I should have let a woman sit down. And I said, well, the woman didn't ask for the seat. She goes, well, I said, why should I give her the seat? She goes, well, because it's a woman and a man should give a woman a seat. And I normally give people seats if they ask it or I think they need it. But this woman, middle-aged, And I said, well, I'm going to need a scorecard. She goes, what do you mean? I go, well, I need to know what day I'm supposed to treat women as equal and what day I'm supposed to hold the door and give them my seat. So I'm not sure what day we're on today.
What did she say?
She didn't say anything. And then I said, why don't you give her your seat? She goes, no. I go, why? She goes, I don't want to. I go, well, then you're being a hypocrite. And we had this conversation. And it was a very weird, first of all, it was inappropriate for her to call me an asshole.
She called you literally an asshole?
Oh, right, yeah. Just right in the thing. Right in the subway. Like, people could hear it. And I really do mean that. Like, I mean, it's like, so, like, I know people that get offended women that get offended if you hold the door for them.
Right.
So I want everybody to be treated the way I'm treated, man, woman, black, white, purple. Like, that's kind of how I sort of approach things.
I think it's a confusing time in
really
so many
do.
Different arenas. And I think the best way to get through confusing times is to try to have civil conversations and say, I'm confused, you know, what's appropriate, what isn't. And as we make these transitions in a different way of thinking and different
right.
attitudes,
right.
how can we kind of do our best and not be crucified if we make mistakes or ask a stupid question or do something wrong? Or
yeah, and that woman could have just come up to me and said something.
Well,
and, you know, or instead of just sort of confronting me. But I mean, you know,
well,
and I would have had a conversation.
I think there's a lot of sort of seething anger that gets unleashed
yeah.
in different times for weird reasons, mm. you know, and yeah, I think that happened to my husband, too, in a subway, but not a different situation where somebody just was, you know, upset and just railing at him. And, oh, God, he would have nothing,
yeah.
you know, he would have none of
yeah.
it. But,
well,
you know,
I mean,
with all the, I think one of the hours I did, and then I know we're wrapping it up, but was on gender inequality in Hollywood and Silicon Valley, which I wanted to do back in July that predated the Me Too and Time's Up movements and even the Harvey Weinstein story. And I wanted to understand, why are women so stuck? You know, why are only 4% of directors women? Why are so few CEOs female? Why, you know, have we just not made more progress given that more women are going to med schools and law schools? And I think more women are I could be wrong, but like the primary breadwinner in their families,
yeah.
you know, and or at least equal. And I was really perplexed, like, what is going on here? And you know, I really looked at less about harassment and more about opportunities.
And what did you find? Like, what was the?
Well, I think some of it, even though people think it can be a cop out, is about implicit bias and the way we're kind of conditioned from the time we
right.
get out of the womb
right.
with certain gender roles and stereotypes that are still very, very powerful and prominent in our lives. And I think that you know, not enough attention has been paid to it and how we can fix things. I think, you know, people hear diversity training or sexual harassment training, they roll their eyes half the time they send their assistants. And
right.
I just don't think it's taken seriously. And I think, you know, people that think they are meritocratic are the least meritocratic because they don't even acknowledge their implicit biases. People hire people who look like themselves. There's a thing called the Rooney Rule, which was established by the coach of the what football team?
Andy, I know the Pittsburgh Steelers.
Uh-huh.
Yeah.
Anyway,
the Rooney family. Yep.
Right. When they were trying to figure out how to have more diversity in the coaching and managerial ranks of the NFL, they decided that for every job opening, at least one minority candidate has to be interviewed. And that's because, as one of the tech women said to me very, you know, eloquently, you can't hire people if you don't even know they exist.
Right. And I also think it goes back to what we were saying. People are comfortable in their tribes,
right.
their cliques, even at work when it's not inherently a race issue, but it's sort of like guys like to be around other guys. And
right. Or, you know, the natural networking system is like, hey, I went to UVA. You went to UVA.
Right.
Hey, were you a Fiji? Hey,
yeah.
you know, were you a Zay? You were. Oh, great. And then you have this sort of instantaneous kind
bond.
Of natural connection that's harder to make with somebody with different life experiences.
Right. And, then,
and so you gravitate
and
towards
then add
people
because to
it increases
look,
your comfort
right.
level.
And then add to that they look very different from
yeah.
you on top of that. And it just becomes hard for the brain to get its head around it.
Yeah.
So
it's kind of lazy, honestly,
yeah.
to just want to be around people who have the same background as you do.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, I could talk to you all
well,
day.
Well, we really solved the problems of the
we
world,
did.
Didn't we, Paul?
We're done now. We're going to go retire in Hawaii.
I'm very excited because I'm going to go home and put my pajamas on and try to go to bed.
Good.
Because and maybe take, what's the best cold medication? What do you recommend?
A big bottle of NyQuil will knock you out for a week. They don't have to deal
Maybe
with
I
it.
Should just have a little Lil Wayne syrup.
Nice.
I'm kidding. I think there's a lot of codeine in that.
Yeah, that's
I interviewed
right.
Lil Wayne.
Did you really?
Yeah, Wheezy. I call him Wheezy. He said, I'm a gangsta, Miss Katie.
That's awesome. I wish I could say
that.
Yeah,
talk about two people who could not be more different. Yeah,
that's
but
like,
he was great.
Yeah.
He was great. He took me on a tour of his face because he has so many tattoos
that's
on his
hilarious.
Face. He was really
a
interesting.
Tour of his face?
Yeah, I said, that's Wheezy, awesome. Tell me about, because he has like, you know, a teardrop and all
right.
these. And then he had a big grill and
was this
everything.
For your podcast?
This was when I was at CBS. I
oh,
think
wow.
I did it for a Grammy special that I did.
Nice, nice.
Yeah, I've had a lot of fun
well,
opportunities
I have you,
like you do,
I want to have
Paul.
I want to have you on again sometime. We'll talk about a whole bunch of other stuff. I really
and we should
talking.
Mention we go to the same church.
We go to the same church. Usually I see
lately.
You on the sidewalk.
They
I'm an usher and now they have female ushers.
Well, it's about damn
big,
time. Honestly,
I fought it. I was like, those women are supposed to be in the kitchen making me dinner. Come
used
on.
Used to bug the shit out of me when I would go to my church.
I know.
And I would see all the ushers and they all look very nice in their outfits and everything. But I would think, really?
Yeah.
Come on. Isn't this like...
And it wasn't the first round. It took a while. You had to break some of these guys down.
It's a very traditional Presbyterian
really
church,
is.
I think, in
yeah.
many ways, but a very nice church.
Yeah.
And I love Michael Linvall,
yeah,
the minister, because I think he was very erudite and always topical, which I appreciated.
And he got you to think about things in a way sometimes that you didn't normally think about, you know,
yeah.
in terms of an approach. And I'm going to miss him. I mean, I don't know who they're going to replace him with, but yeah, I thought he was very...
So you're pretty active, so you're not Catholic. If you're an Italian kid, you weren't raised a Catholic.
I was raised Catholic.
You
My
were
wife's
Catholic.
Presbyterian,
oh, okay.
But we just basically liked the church. We liked the vibe of the church.
It's
we got
pretty,
turned
isn't
on
it?
To it for this tree lighting ceremony.
Uh-huh,
we
yeah.
thought this is pretty cool, because we just moved to the neighborhood, and like, well, if this is the kind, let's go check it out.
I wish it were more diverse.
Yeah, I know. But look where we live. Look at that area. It's
yeah.
That's the problem,
no,
right?
No, that's true.
I mean, you know, churches tend and temples tend to be very sort of, you know, about
reflect the neighborhood.
Reflect the neighborhood. So, you know, but I think people are, for the most part, I understand why they want it to be structured and traditional. I think they're trying to sort of, and I respect it because I think, like we've been talking about, the world's changing so much and changing so fast. And people say, I think they're trying to kind of anchor people in sort of, well, this is
there's
kind
something
of,
nice about a ritual. And
there's a sort of a thing that's done a certain way.
Do you know, I'm the one that suggested, I don't know if I'll get any credit for it, that the peace be with you.
Oh, really?
Yeah, because I felt like the church, I felt like it sometimes felt quite cold.
Yeah.
And I thought, wouldn't it be nice just to say, you know, what is it called? The passing of the peace or whatever
yeah,
it's called? Or,
yeah, I'm not sure.
Anyway, but I thought if... as long as you're not a germ freak, to be able to kind of say hello to the people sitting around you in
yeah.
church is just a nice thing to be able to
yeah.
do.
Yeah. I got the flu. Thanks to you for that. No, I'm just kidding. No, I do. I remember doing it in the Catholic church.
Yeah.
And I remember not doing it at Brick Church. And then I had
they
no
didn't
idea.
Want it. They didn't want it because they thought I think it was too Catholic.
Oh yeah. There's that whole thing. But I think it's good. You know, we did it too, because we were raising our son. He was just born. So I know your folks are here. We got to get you out of here.
I know. We could talk all day. We're
I know. This is so fun.
Thank you, Paul, for having me.
Oh, absolutely.
And more importantly, thank you for watching the show.
Oh, absolutely.
And I hope you'll encourage your listeners. There's 6 hours, everybody. And shameless plug, it's on demand,
mm-hmm.
Nat Geo channel, but also on Hulu.
And so Facebook, too.
On your way to The Handmaid's Tale, watch this America Inside Out. It's also on YouTube and Facebook. And, you know, they're not really going to be dated.
No, not
so
at all.
I think you can watch them anytime in the next 5 years.
Right. And then I'm
hopefully they'll have a long tail, Paul, as they say.
They will have a very long tail. You're going to have a long sleep after you drink your bottle of NyQuil. And hopefully we got to grab dinner with the spouses.
That would be fun.
You know,
that would be fun.
I think you met my wife briefly on the sidewalk of the
yes,
church, but she's
I
a
did.
Very lovely person.
Yes. Isn't that nice? That's a nice thing to say about your
school.
Wife.
I was a
you're
senior.
In high school.
Come on. You're going to let this hunky piece of meat go? Come on. What are you, crazy? Look at this. All right. Katie Couric. Sick and all, lovely, beautiful as always. Great, great docuseries. Wednesday night, 10 a.m. You can also get episodes that have already run on Hulu, Facebook, YouTube, on demand.
I'll send you a DVD.
They're going to be shot in the clouds, so
yeah.
People can watch it. Thank you so much for being on.
Thank you, Paul.
All right, that was Katie Couric.
How cool is that? And she played sick, man. She left it all out on the field. All right, I hope you enjoyed it. Please go on to iTunes and leave some comments for me about the show. And nice ones only, of course. And go to deepdiscount.com. Go to my website, paulmercurio.com. Click on the link and go check out all the cool stuff they got there. All right, see you guys next week. Thanks.